From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we begin a series of conversations with Luciana Bone. Among other things, she's a retired professor from the public university called Edinburgh University in Pennsylvania. She's also a film critic, a prolific writer, particularly on topics pertaining to Marxist analysis of history, and is featured regularly at counterpunch.org. We spoke with her via Skype from Pennsylvania Wednesday and discussed some of the topics that will be covered in the series. I am so honored to be able to speak with you, and honored also, Luciana, that you've agreed to do regular conversations here about all of these different things. So first of all, welcome and thank you.
Thank you, and I'm grateful and honored to be on your program.
So we started, I've been following you for years on Facebook and then out in the world, other places where your writings are published. And I think, you know, you've lit me up about a lot of different things and you know, made me aware of things and made me think more critically about some things. And I really appreciate that. And I thought this is something definitely that I would like to share with our audience. And in the process of our figuring out how to do this, we actually realized maybe we should work out the process of what we're going to do in front of the audience and get some input from them, too, you know, as at the end we'll give some contact information. So we have, though, first of all, a whole collection of your work out in the internet and in the world of your writings on politics and you know, film and
personal stuff too.
Yeah, and these are all things that are interesting. And you know what you mentioned personal. We were just talking off mic about some things that you know, deal with that whole the question of large individuals in history as opposed to the workers and such. And I maybe we could start picking it up there, because we were talking about, I mentioned, for example, the who were the radio operators that operated the radios that Fidel used to broadcast to Havana and around Cuba that organized the revolution. Mm-hmm. People don't know who those folks are, but they're key. And that's kind of like what the working class is in the operation of the economy and its role in history to this point.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that, well, let's see, the whole history of Marxism has disappeared. You know, the class struggle, that's what we need to talk about. What, you know, what is colonialism?
Yeah, I think maybe, I mean, this is one of the things right now that is completely missing from the conversation. Even where people talk about, for example, racism and 1%, 99%, they... No one draws a connection between imperialism and, you know, capitalist or the whole system of capitalism at the local national level. And so people, the working class is able to be divided because of that. Because if I'm working on working class issues in the United States, I don't care what's going on in South Africa or wherever, then we can be divided.
Yes. That is the key, and I'm working on, but it's hard, and I'm collecting quotes, and most of the stuff I share on Facebook, and therefore I drain what I could, I drain the, once I write it down, it's down, you see, and then I don't feel I have to revisit it. But anyway, I'm working on the whole idea of how the colonies is a class. How a colony is a class, or a semi-colony, or a coveted territory. The whole, so to give you a concrete example, and this may be pushing it, but Syria, in relation to Western imperialism, it's a class.
Which makes the war on Syria basically a class war.
Yes. That's the leap we have to make. So China, if you have a long view of history and you see the 1949 Chinese Revolution as an anti-colonial struggle first, then support for China's survival as an anti-colonial revolution becomes class solidarity.
Hmm. You know, that's an interesting point if you consider the history of how, what it made me think of is, you know, there are a variety of places, say in Africa, for example, where bourgeois revolutions, or in any event, rebellions or a handover of power under bourgeois terms, was juxtaposed to or substituted for the actual liberation struggles that either in places like Angola were successful or in places like Congo were crushed and ground into mincemeat, by the way, as they did with Lumumba. And you know, we were asked to accept as a success the accomplishment of bourgeois revolutions in those places. And yet, the same people that were asking us to do and continue to ask us to do that today, have no tolerance whatsoever for China deviating ideologically an iota from their perceived Marxist ideal, which is pretty bizarre.
Yes, yes. We're talking about left position toward national struggle.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
Yeah. First of all, Marxist theory of history is, equivalent to Darwin's theory of evolution. Mm. It's so sweeping and so applicable. All history, I can't remember now the quotation, but I'll have it in front of me, is the history of the struggle among the classes. Mm. So if you take something like an African struggle for independence, let's see what the classic case would be. Well, let's say Kenya. So you have independence, right, in 1962 in Kenya. But then within independence, you have a national bourgeoisie. Of course, you have always the workers who did the most of the work of striking and stuff like that. And in Kenya, for example, you had the workers, you had the national bourgeoisie, and you had, waiting in the wings, a comprador bourgeoisie. So you can actually have a struggle within the same class. The national bourgeoisie tends to be anti-imperialistic. That I know from Iran. And the comprador bourgeoisie tends to kowtow to imperialist interest out of self-interest, out of the benefits. They're opportunists.
Right. They get a cut.
Yeah. They get a cut. And they compromise.
Right.
So, for example, in China, the Communist Party recognizes the national bourgeoisie as anti-imperialist. What they actually persecute is the comprador, clean out, is the comprador bourgeoisie. Mm. So I don't know the figures, who are they, what, but that is the danger within tolerating, as the Communist Party does, the bourgeoisie. That is, they can do a few, they can be enterprisers, they can bring in wealth, but we check them, which was not done in the Soviet Union.
Mm, right.
So they learned from the Soviet Union, not to open the party up to indiscriminate membership, which was blah, 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 blah. But all I'm trying to say is that the theory of the class struggle really, really works. The theory that all history hitherto, whatever the quotation is, which I can usually quote if I'm not on the phone, the Marxist theory of history, if applied, works. It explains how history happens, why revolutions in Africa are undermined not only from outside, but from inside, from class interests. Mm. It's big, and I hope I can bring it down to, comprehensive level. How important is Marxist theory of history to the present, to the analysis of situations in the present.
I mean,
think about it.
If you apply it,
can you bring it down to any kind of more specific?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of. I mean, I'm watching the map pop as I visualize your concept here, because if you think about you have an ongoing class struggle. Maybe it's permanent revolution, quote unquote, maybe not. But at this point, it's still you're looking at it as a dynamic. And so you have the national bourgeoisie that has this set of interests it wants to pursue, both as against the working class and as against the comprador or local international bourgeoisie, whatever. They've got the thing, the carrot you can dangle in front of them. You know what the compradors are trying to do, and you know that they are the ones that are tied to a global threat. And so you can build an alliance and tamping that down. And then, of course, each of the two sectors of the bourgeoisie look at the working class and its control, to the extent it has it, of the party as lunch. You know, they want that. And so you look at how it plays out in a place like Nicaragua, where there's a very good relationship between the radical government and the national bourgeoisie, who are prospering under that arrangement.
Excellent example, yes.
Then you have the two out in the streets in Venezuela and also in Argentina and Brazil, where the divisions there are pretty interesting for sure. But the compradors have been able to gain power in both of those two countries, the office of the president in each case, and also the national legend. I mean, they're so evenly divided on the street that anyone that's close to the reins of power, and with the help of the media that's privately controlled, they're there. So that's another model. You've got China then. If you think of China in that context, China is a huge success. Look at by every measure, and yet the left here spends all their time deciding, as if they could, whether or not China is a socialist country.
Yes, and I'm also tinkering with the idea, how did the erasure or the forgetting of Marx's law of history, the disappearance of his main, all human history is the result of the class struggle, that disappearance of consciousness in actually younger generation makes it possible for them to agree to make war on the basis of human rights? That's my question.
Whose human rights and who's violating them and under what, by what mechanisms? I mean, none of that even comes in, because it takes you back to the class nature of it.
Yeah. Who decides?
Right.
What is human rights? In other words, I mean, the knee-jerk reaction would be, whatever, Assad represents the national anti-imperialist bourgeoisie. Therefore, we should listen to the appeal for human rights with some consciousness of this fact that Syria comes out of a colonial history. Is Assad a comprador, like, let's say, Mobutu? No.
Right. That's right.
Is Assad, in certain respects, he was liberalizing, doing whatever he, I don't know and I don't care. Because the main point is he resisting imperialism or is he cooperating with it?
Yep. I mean, that's the strategic question. And then if you have a moral question that you have to ask, you ask next, and what do the people of Syria think? And if they also think, and if they also think this is the guy to support, because we think, A, strategically he should be, because it's one less asset for imperialism to use against the rest of us. And then, two, the Syrian people want this, by the way. They have a right of self-determination. It seems like a no-brainer.
It does, doesn't it? And then if the Syrian people say, no, Assad is, we're fighting Assad because he's he's a tyrant, then okay.
Right.
Not specific groups, you know.
Right.
But the voice must come from
the people.
The people from that specific situation.
Right.
They're not saying Assad is a tyrant. They voted for him. So you're right. It's the theory of history of how it works is applicable to every situation in the world today, and if you don't have it, you defend human rights in Syria and you get 400,000 people killed on the moral level. I mean, it doesn't tally. Same in Libya. Even morally, it doesn't tally. Well, utilitarian, and you know, from the point of view of utilitarian ethics, numbers.
Right.
So, that's what I think is the crucial thing. Questioning, putting under debate what Marx called the scientific theory of history. How does it go? Do you remember?
Here it is. You want to hear it? The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles.
Yes.
That's it.
One thing that's problematic is that Marx wrote in German and all these words, proletariat, which practically had to be invented in 1840, you know.
Yep.
The word proletariat doesn't mean anything to us because what, you know, what is the proletariat in the United States? I suppose it's the people that go on strike and we don't hear about it. People who listen to my interview, somebody, Farhad, the Persian, says, class was in session. And it took me 2 days to see that he was punning. I said, damn it, that was clever. He was pointing out, you know, the emphasis that I put.
Yeah. We have a lot of problems as looking at ourselves as a global class and communicating. First of all, we have not, at least I wasn't. Most people are not educated in, you're a working person, and part of an international class, and so we need to have a language to communicate in and blah, blah. I mean, Marxism is that, but they don't really, grow us up like, here's a class in how to be a working class person and develop yourself and your class. They don't teach us that in school as like a course of study.
Yes, that's some abstraction up there that you need to know. Yeah, no.
I'm going to read just that one paragraph to its conclusion because I think it's an excellent framework for us to keep in mind going forward. So it's all right. So the history of all hitherto existing societies is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, a fight that each time ended, either in a revolutionary reconstitution of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes. In a nutshell, in a nutshell. So looking at this stuff today and applying this, and you have people that call themselves Marxist and Marxist scholars and independent Marxist socialist scholars and all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah, socialists, etc. And they look at you like you're from Mars when you actually try to look at current events in that frame.
That's right, in materialist, yes. That is my obsession. How do I gain clarity for myself so that I can speak plainly and clearly about this? So what I'm going to do is accept that this may be the theme, this quotation you just read, and apply it to current situations.
Yeah, I think
apply
that's a good
it,
idea.
I don't know, bring up Venezuela. What do you think?
Yeah, exactly. In other words,
you're like, you could say, what do you think is happening? How do you think this applies to Venezuela? How do you think this applies to Ukraine?
Right.
Which we should leave as last. Because
yeah, I know.
Because it's complicated. Yeah,
it's very complicated. Also, it's very weighty. I mean, that's, there's a possible flashpoint for World War III and the end of our species, like hanging around there too. And every couple days, lobbing a couple grenades across the border or whatever to make sure the fire stays lit.
Yeah.
It's a little unsettling.
I think that I wonder how much blackmail is involved in that. Look, you! World War III is in the offing. I mean, I don't mean to say that they don't intend to make it.
No, I got you.
But it's also a form of keeping us afeared.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know. Okay, the problem of the world today is imperialism, which is not just the United States. It just happens to be the most vested in it. Mm. And that leads to war.
Yeah.
Historically, I mean, I don't know if we... You know, not every future is the repetition of the past. Mm. And that's recognized by Lenin. You cannot replicate the Russian Revolution, and the Chinese say you cannot replicate the Chinese. Every revolution has specific features, events, you know. So that's what is really meant by Chinese with Chinese characteristics,
right,
socialism.
Yeah.
What they mean is their historically specific condition. They
right.
don't mean, you know, although they parade at Confucius or how it's interpreted, values. You know, instead of history, it's interpreted as values, with Chinese values. But no, what they mean is the specific characteristic of China having been the object of imperialism, of
right.
Western imperialism.
In the specific way, and with the specific acts that happened
way.
And all that stuff. I mean, because, you know, China goes into that relationship as China with the history it had before. It meets Britain or, you know, whichever imperial power on whichever front, you know, on those terms, under those historical conditions, with the international alliances that had taken shape then, for example, whatever the relationship between the U.S. and Japan was at the moment or whatever, all of that moshes into something and something comes out as, it's like making a stew. You know, if I have in the house veal and string beans and tomatoes and onions and that's what I make that's what I make a stew out of.
That's exactly
okay.
The right
tomorrow
analogy.
If you have pork and corn or something else, I could tell you to make stew. Well, guess what? You can't make the stew I made. You're just gonna make the stew with what you got.
Exactly. And that's right. So the difference between, for instance, the Russian Revolution and the Chinese Revolution is that the Russian Revolution came in part, in great part, out of imperial competition between empires, between the
right.
Russian Empire and British, with the greatest aggression on the British side or conspiracy.
Mm.
So then you had, you know, World War I, and the revolution came out of that. The crisis in China was not that China was competing like Russia with the West for empire position, but as a subject of imperialism.
Right.
So that was specific.
Right. Absolutely. And an essential
point. And that's
point.
Exactly the stew business. You work with what you have, and you make something out of what is there, materially,
yep.
and specifically, yes.
Yep. Yeah, so, and then, you know, some people are hell-bent on calling it veal stew, even if you have pork, and they'll tell you you can't have stew unless you have veal. That's essentially, you know, oh, well, this is, you couldn't have that kind of revolution in Russia. You know, they talk about the, you know, the failure of the vanguard model or however it's framed, but that, you know, that was bound to fail. And, it's, you know, leaving out, of course, the global effort sustained over a century almost, for example, at the Soviet Union and the half century at China and, you know, the centuries against our class, like
boycotts.
Yeah.
Isolation, threats.
Mm-hmm. A couple of atomic bombs. It's not like there was nothing going on. This is supposedly an internal, intrinsic failure as opposed to being blown into oblivion.
I wonder if we can also split it into, you know, how important is Marxist theory of history, and the second thing, where did the West fail? Where does Western, that calls itself left, fails? And that will get us into what I think is the problem, which is from the beginning, a lack of recognition or acknowledgement of of colonial, third world is what I'm going to call it. But anyway, the colonial world struggles. Mm. I mean, I read Eric Hobsbawm. I've been reading Eric Hobsbawm lately. He says that socialism failed. In 2009, you know, just shortly before he died, in an article in The Guardian, socialism failed. And what does he use? And he's sorry about it. I mean, this is not somebody who he considers himself a communist. Communist Party member of Britain the whole life. And he says socialism has failed. And what does he use as an example? The Soviet Union. Mm. Then he says the future of the world is a mixed economy, and he never mentions China.
Talking about, I mentioned earlier both Nicaragua and Venezuela. One of the innovations, in my opinion, and not necessarily his innovation, but maybe an innovation in the approach to this hemisphere, was Chavez's willingness and promotion of the idea that China also, I think, pioneered, but also uses as its, the basis of its win-win philosophy. Look, you guys govern your territory however you like. You run your societies and cultures however you like. You want to engage with us, we'll engage with you, supporting each other's sovereignty, right to self-determination, and trying to uplift each other with our transactions, while we're all in the business of trying to uplift ourselves. Like, that is kind of the way that Chavez engaged, and got Latin American countries to engage each other, and the Caribbean countries, first ALBA groupings, and then, ultimately you end up with CELAC and UNASUR. But, where we've got each other's backs and we're going out on the world stage as, team players on the same team.
I really don't see how that is, the Chinese position, the Chavez position, differs from Lenin's.
Right. Agreed.
And that's evident in the first three decrees that I always mention. Peace first, and then next, we look at our population. So in this case, in Russia, we redistribute the land. Mm. And the third is we support anti-colonial struggles. Mm. That's a theoretical basis, and then we go into the new economic plan, which is exactly win-win.
Yeah.
Well, that's, they don't,
They didn't use that terminology. They didn't have Madison Avenue back then, okay?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, we have. So win-win, it sounds. But it wasn't, the new economic plan came out of the realization of the weakness of the revolutionary horizon. The weakness and the weakness of the Soviet Union. So they had to let in they had to let in capitalism, investment, etc. Mm-hmm. It's more akin to Cuba as in the 1990. It's a question of survival, the new economic plan, which we can define, etc. But Lenin's new economic plan was really, a step back of the revolution, mm-hmm. but a way to survive.
Right.
And Fidel, I remember somebody reading or telling me that when he announced the special period, the laws of double economy,
right.
He just turned his back on whoever, on the assembly, kind of in defeat. It's a step back. Mm. I acknowledge that. But if it helps the revolution or whatever, to survive, then, Jesus, why don't they understand this?
Right. That's a good spot for us to pick it up next week. We'll take a look at what Lenin did, actually having to govern, the kind of, reality check that you get.
Yep.
And and start applying that to some of the things going on here. Thank you, Luciana. It's been a pleasure.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.